Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome everyone to Hidden Growth Champions, our podcast series. Today in our virtual studio, and as part of our focus on healthcare and the important role that it plays in our life, I've got Dr. Augusta Dorning. Augusta, I remember in one of our introductions a while back, you were sharing with me your illustrious career in the industry and some of the fantastic work you've done, both in public as well as private sector. Please introduce yourself to our audience. I'm so very much looking forward to our conversation and to learn from your many insights into the healthcare challenges on the African continent. Please go ahead.
So thank you so much for the opportunity. It's an absolute privilege for me to have this conversation with you today. I've been very blessed over the course of my 38-year career in healthcare in South Africa. My first 18 years was spent in the public sector in the KwaZulu-Natal Department of Health. And I was so privileged to watch the change and the dawn of the new democracy moving into the healthcare space and all the incredible developments that took place during that time and still continue to take place. Thereafter, I spent 5 years in the most incredible non-governmental health organization, which was then the last remaining Catholic hospital in South Africa by the name of St. Mary's Catholic Mission Hospital at Marion Hill, just outside of Durban. And then by some incredible stroke of luck, I was allowed to join the private sector. And I spent 13 incredible years with Netcare, heading up St. Augustine's Hospital in Durban, which is the oldest hospital in the province of KwaZulu-Natal, and then later very blessed to join LenMed to take forward their Africa healthcare strategy. And I am the head of Africa business at LenMed, which is the fourth largest private healthcare group in South Africa.
That's fantastic. Now, I'm sure throughout your career, you've come across firsthand some of the more endemic, the more challenging, the more systemically complex healthcare challenges. And one that we've spoken about in a previous conversation that affects not just here in South Africa, but in many parts of Africa and increasingly and an accelerated rate in emerging markets, which is around obesity. I know it's something you have great passion for and great intent on helping to solve. Perhaps tell us a little bit more about the challenge first. What is the obesity challenge? Why is it featuring and rearing its head so pervasively on the African continent? And why does it matter now more than ever?
Thanks, Sar. So as you've rightly indicated, this is an absolute passion of mine, and it stemmed from an interest that developed as a result of me being asked to speak about the issue at the African Renaissance Conference in 2018. So my academic area of interest is that of leadership and leadership development. And in considering the topic of childhood obesity back then, I was astounded to learn about how the leadership role within households have such a profound impact on children and their development as future citizens of our continent. And back in 2018, childhood obesity was already a global public health concern. So you'll note I've said global. And as I delved into what the impact of this could be on the African continent, of course, being blissfully unaware that there could even be an obesity issue, because we're well aware of adult obesity concerns. It's certainly a prevalent factor of our daily life as we look at the increase in non-communicable diseases. So communicable diseases being, of course, now COVID, and then previously HIV/AIDS and tuberculosis inter alia. But then looking at the burden of a non-communicable disease, as we saw a prevalence in adults of diabetes, hypertension, and cardiac disease across the continent. And you would always, looking from the external perspective, imagine that this could not be a feature of the African continent. But let me just describe to you the prevalence of childhood obesity on the continent. And it features in the lower and middle income groups. And how it features is that 24% of children on the continent are overweight, and 10% are morbidly obese. That is a staggering number. And it's truly nothing short of a public health crisis. But because in healthcare, we are faced with so many challenges. Childhood obesity has not really come to the fore because it's not a priority if you look at the bigger picture. But on our continent, 87% of obese children live in lower and middle income countries. That is profound. So it's not a disease of the affluent only. And this epidemic has been increasing by more than 400% every decade. Is that not just a staggering number? Undernutrition, so not malnutrition, children who are getting meals but are not getting nutrition within a meal are presenting in 30.3%, in other words, nearly 31% of obese children. And wasting is presenting in nearly 3% of obese children. So we think that we are feeding our children, but we are actually undernourishing them. And the consequence of this, which I'm sure we'll explore later on, is that we are actually preventing children from reaching their full potential, both physically, emotionally, and intellectually. And I mean, the impact of this cannot be underestimated. And it all comes back to the primary caregiver behavior. So my role as a mother, your role as a father, and the example that we are setting to our children in our own eating and lifestyle behaviors. Isn't this just, it's just so profound.
As you were describing it, it really occurred to me that this is more than just a patient-specific challenge. This is more than just about the individual and a healthcare provider. This is a systemic issue that affects far more. It affects the family. It affects communities. It affects the productive capacity of a nation. It affects our ability to develop. So this is something that has far-reaching implications well beyond just treating the individual.
Absolutely. And physical obesity goes hand in hand with hypertension, heart disease, and type 2 diabetes. Emotional obesity generates issues of self-esteem, self-worth, and anxiety. In a school setting, obesity generates bullying and ostracization. So at a very personal level, we're dealing with little individuals who are being harmed both physically and emotionally as a result of caregiver behavior and the example that caregivers are setting for them. And we're also seeing numerous studies revealing how obesity and undernutrition is lowering the child's ability to attain their educational milestones. So we're just denying our children the ability to develop not only their potential, but also to live full lives. And if you look in the societal context, there are unfortunately numerous barriers to healthy behaviors, not least of all the influence of social media. And that is probably an entirely separate conversation for many days, but it's well documented how influential social media is as far as children are concerned. And there are many studies that have documented the influence of certain social media platforms, which I obviously won't mention, on anorexia, poor eating habits, lifestyle, etc. But healthy food, unless it's produced and consumed at the source, for example, on a farm or in a rural setting, is actually expensive. And access to healthy food is limited for most people in lower and middle income groups. You know, if you look at the informal settlements, which we see prevailing across many large cities in Africa, how on earth are those families to have access to healthy food? Because they don't have the luxury of having a vegetable patch in their backyard. They are just trying to survive and keep their children going. And as a result, very low value food has to be provided. Because what are the options? So what are the options?
Yes, no, 100%. When I think about this challenge, the word that comes to mind for me is, and this is something we often challenge leadership teams in our own work to do, is to ask the question, should we reframe what the problem is? It's very easy to look at the problem as a given and say, we have a healthcare challenge, we have an obesity challenge. But when we start to reframe the actual question, whether it's about taking on a completely different challenge to solve, or whether it's refining what the challenge is within those broad paradigms, we often find that there are better questions to answer. There are more meaningful challenges we need to answer. And the challenge that we ultimately go about solving is very often different than what we thought at the beginning. We were solving for X, but actually we found out through this process and through understanding the problem in its totality and understanding the various role players that are here and the impact that it kind of has and cascades through the ecosystem, that it's actually something quite different. So if I had to ask you, when we think about this challenge in your work in this area, would you frame the problem differently now than what you would have, say, 5 or 10 years ago?
Absolutely. So the first response, exactly to your point, is to say that this is the responsibility of a government. And of course, we have many governments across Africa, but it's actually a response of the education system. Many, many years ago, one was taught at school which food groups would serve your development and your health best. I wonder whether those discussions are still at play, or whether even those basic discussions which educate people in how to take care of their bodies have not moved off the educational agenda. And were that discussion not to be taking place at the school level, is that discussion taking place in the home? Are people able to have that discussion because of urbanization and the challenge that I presented to you in our earlier part of the conversation? Is this realistic, but is it something that can be ignored? And of course, I'm arguing that it cannot be ignored because it is so fundamental to developing active, healthy, and contributing citizen to the wealth and prosperity of our continent, which we know is entirely possible with a change of leadership direction and a change of attitude at this very basic level. It's a fascinating conversation, which has many tenets in the psychology of families, the role of the family unit, the role that the mother plays, the role that the father can play in the absence of the mother, the role that the grandmother may play in the absence of both. And if we look at the orphan populations and how in our African context, family is so important and who steps in to play which role at which particular time, it's an amazing conversation and a very important conversation that is not up in the intellectual or the academic realm, but really at the basis of many religious discussions which could be taking place, given the importance of religion and the role that religion plays on our continent. So that's an additional aspect that we could look at introducing and have dialogue around, so that the right influence is brought to bear on the child in the interests of the child.
Now, if I think of it from how the healthcare sector has traditionally treated obesity, what would you say the more common or traditional approaches have been?
They've certainly been around treatment. So in other words, let's look at the condition and we don't dig too deep, because digging deep takes time. Where there is ability, be it financial or systemic, to deal with the root cause of the problem, of course it can be dealt with. But if you look at a busy clinic in a rural area or in an urban area for that matter, how often would the primary healthcare sister who's looking after that clinic and the patients who subscribe to the treatment of that clinic, how often is that primary healthcare nurse able to spend half an hour even, which is not enough as far as this topic is concerned, but how often is that primary healthcare practitioner able to sit with the primary caregiver and the child and analyze, what are you eating? How's this playing out? How much sugar are you consuming? How much salt are you consuming? What is your diet actually made up of? I would postulate that they never have the time to do that, because the volume and the pressure of entry into that healthcare facility does not facilitate conversations such as this. Perhaps in the private sector setting, some of these conversations can take place. And certainly within our facilities, where we have a deep focus on pediatric care, there are certainly these conversations taking place. But if you look at childhood health and the way that obesity and larger frame children are even perceived in certain communities, they also gendered notions of acceptable behavior. And in many cultures, being well padded, being voluptuous is a sign of prosperity, interestingly enough, as opposed to being stick thin and appearing emaciated or wasted. So you'll know in your experience, in some cultures, if a child looks a bit sort of pudgy, they're considered to be healthy as opposed to potentially being a candidate for diabetes and hypertension. So you have some very interesting cultural perceptions around what a healthy child looks like. And it's quite a difficult conversation for even a practitioner to enter into if the baseline observations and condition of the child are not already presenting as a diabetes or a hypertension. It's a very interesting topic, because do you want to step away from the cultural norm of somebody looking well? Very tricky.
So, Augusta, what could we do different, seeing that we're trying to solve this problem traditionally in a very narrow sense, and even in that, there's a real challenge. There isn't a straight line to the solution. Even approaching the conversation in that traditional sense is a challenge in itself. So if we take a little bit of perspective, if we step back for a little bit and we look at the problem more broadly, what are some of the things that will help us to not just look ourselves in the mirror, but in fact examine other potentially brighter parts of the problem that we could solve or solve more readily, maybe even rethink what we should be solving for here?
So you make a very good point. So the first step in any situation is awareness. And following awareness becomes education. If you look at public health spending on advertising, on making communities conscious and aware of what their issues are, there is very little to nothing out in the public space around this issue. And there's been incredible research conducted which can inform a dialogue of precisely this nature. There are also incredible opportunities for the private sector and for food producers, and I'm saying food producers in a very broad sense. Every single medical insurance fund, every food producer, to take a socially responsible stance on this issue and start educating, as opposed to unselling unhealthy and really purely nutrified food. So there's a massive opportunity on a social and a business level to influence this. And we know how powerful advertising is. If we change the slant of advertising by only a 25% percentile, you would be looking at a change in almost the same degree of the population because of advertising being so powerful. And of course, advertising takes, you know, can take place on various platforms, be it by way of radio, if that is what the community responds to, on social media, on television, you know, on streaming networks, etc. But the awareness has not been created, and that is a civil duty that we are all responsible for holding and for taking forward.
Now, Augusta, maybe this might be a good place to bring in a little bit of your work and what you do as head of Africa at LenMed. Speak to us a little bit about that and in what ways that speaks to taking a different approach to dealing with these kinds of challenges like obesity.
Thanks, Sar. So LenMed, as I indicated earlier, is the fourth largest healthcare provider in South Africa. We are one of the few groups on the African continent who do pursue an Africa strategy. And the primary focus of that strategy, as has always been the case with LenMed, and I'll come to our legacy and history in just a short while, but has been to provide access. So we are acutely aware, as is everybody, of course, that access to healthcare on the continent is significantly limited. And it is our focus, in keeping with our legacy, which I'd just like to share with you briefly, if I may. LenMed has always positioned as a community-based group. And as I indicated, our history is actually testament to this. And I'm going to share with you the dream that was brought to being in as early as 1977. in the so-called black tea room at Barrow Gwynedd Hospital. I mean, can you believe that we're referring back to 1977 when Dr. A. Lateeb, who was a founder of LenMed and was then a practicing gynecologist at Barrow, as we fondly refer to Barrow Gwynedd Hospital, came up with the idea of establishing a clinic in Lanasia, which is adjacent to Soweto for everyone who knows South Africa. And this clinic would serve to bring excellent health services to non-white communities. So probably most people have forgotten what it was like back in 1977, but healthcare was extremely polarized. And essentially, only the white population group of South Africa had access to private services, and the rest of the population had to make do with public services. And in that particular area, being Soweto and Lanasia, there was absolutely nothing that could serve those communities. And Dr. Lateeb then went on in 1978 to discuss his thoughts with the founders of what is today LenMed. And in 1984, LenMed Clinic, which is today proudly constructed in the memory of Ahmed Kathrada, which we all know was an incredible apartheid stalwart, in 1984, the LenMed Clinic was born. And in fact, today, some people still refer to Ahmed Kathrada Private Hospital, which is one of our flagship hospitals, as the LenMed Clinic, which is quite precious, I think. So the LenMed Clinic in Lanasia was a prefabricated structure of 47 beds, was served by a handful of doctors and supported by a small complement of nurses and admin staff. And Dr. Farouk Kaka, who still serves with us, performed the first surgical procedure back in 1984. So that incredible spirit, which we still pervade today on the continent of Africa and which serves all of our initiatives into Africa, be they prospective or already established, set up this trailblazing facility, which, as I said today, is still one of our flagship facilities. And then over the period from 1984 to 2006, the group made local acquisitions in South Africa, in Ladysmith and in Tembisa, once again right down into the communities which had been underserved, bought other hospitals up until that point. And then in 2011, so nearly 11 years ago, the group started venturing into Africa, building, which was very brave in those days, the first private hospital in Maputo in Mozambique. And this hospital, which is a comprehensive facility, serves the entire region and not only Mozambique. In 2012, so almost just a year after that, the group bought the Bakamoso Private Hospital in Gaborone, Botswana. And this is a flagship 235-bed hospital providing comprehensive care to the citizens of Botswana. And I'm proud to say that at Bakamoso Private Hospital, we even provide oncology services, which for a small country like Botswana is quite remarkable. So the group has continued to grow, but of course, never moving away from its community roots. And we prefer to take on hospitals in underserved areas, which is what we still do to this day. Our pediatric capabilities are well known. And here in Durban, where I'm fortunate to have my office, we have the only pediatric center of excellence in the province with 11 specialist disciplines represented at this hospital. And it's also the only hospital to provide pediatric cardiac surgery in the province, which is amazing. And I can also very proudly share with you that as of today, we have the American Cardiac Foundation accreditation bestowed on us, and this hospital is indeed the only hospital in Africa, SAR, to have this accreditation. I think that is an incredible achievement. So just to share a little bit about the group, we are growing. We have 13 hospitals and 3 are outside of South Africa. We last year secured a contract in Ghana, which was very exciting for us. And we are the proud managers of the Bank of Ghana Hospital in Accra. We are also positioning to have a digital foothold in Africa, as we have full faith and confidence that the African continent is a great place to invest in. and provide world-class care, as well as do business in, which is, of course, very important for the sustainability of any business. We've always believed that we have a lot to offer the African communities, including our own, of course, and we do this with great humility, given our experience in our South African communities, which were previously underserved as a result of the legacy of apartheid. So we have our hearts in the right places. We truly believe that we should be close to our communities, and our legacy is testimony to this.
Now, if I take you kind of, if you project forward a bit and say we were talking 5 years from now and your presence in other African markets was possibly some physical and some markets where you were acquired into, but certainly from everything you described, certainly a digital foothold that has now grown. What would you say that you are able to do? What would you say that the kind of things that will make you proud, that would make you think, this wasn't possible 5 years ago. We weren't able to provide the service, let alone in those markets, but even here in South Africa, that is possible 5 years down the line. I know I'm kind of asking you to cast and use a bit of imagination, but you've been very much involved in leading this effort of growing LendMed in Africa. So I'm curious to hear, what are the kind of things that come possible then?
So it's a great question, and it's really easy to answer because for us, it's always been about world-class care. And world-class care is not easy to come by in Africa for all the reasons that we already know. Access to healthcare is not easy. But then on the converse, if you look at all the communities in Africa, many of these communities use their own money to procure healthcare. And it has been our ambition and our goal, in very plain language, to bring world-class care to underserved communities. And I know that we will do that in every territory where we can gain access. And we know in our hearts that we can provide a great service. So it's not a difficult question to answer because it makes up our DNA and it's part of who we are.
If I had to turn the page for a moment and talk a little bit about leadership, I know it's something we don't often put formally on the agenda, but it's something that the kind of transformation that you spoke about right from the early days in the 1970s, there was essentially a leadership call, right? Someone had to take a stand. Someone decided this is important enough. Someone had the vision of creating this kind of a hospital group that didn't exist in those days. And the degree to which communities were underserved was staggering. So when you think about how the group is led into these African markets, how you are leading yourselves into a much more of a digital environment where the boundaries between healthcare provider and consumer become very blurred, how would you describe the leadership shift that has taken place or that is taking place? What are those aspects that often are not visible to investors, to the general public, but are critical for the success of this kind of transformation?
So that's a very precious question, because from the inception of LendMed, the key values have been around humility, understanding, listening, and not assuming that because we are in South Africa, we know best. Humility has been at the center of our approach, not only in South Africa, but into Africa. And why I say that is that if you look at basic leadership values, basic organizational values, good manners, and the ability to build relationships are core to the success of any business and any organization for that matter. If you are open and humble in listening to people and listening for what they want and need, you will never be disappointed. And that premise has been the foundation of what our forefathers in LendMed set out to do. They established that there was a need. And we know because we've spoken about it on this conversation, and certainly we speak about it often within our organization. They listened to what was needed. They didn't enforce a solution on a community who wanted something else. And when you venture into Africa, and it's always so interesting to me, when you say to people that you come from South Africa when one's traveling abroad, people will say, oh, from Africa. And then you say no from South Africa. And I hear other colleagues speaking about their countries of origin. And often people are very quick to just put you into the pot with the rest of Africa without realizing that there are hundreds of cultures, hundreds of affiliation, different forms of religious belief, different forms of cultural belief. And it's so important to listen and to be sensitive to the needs of that community in whichever form it has now presented for you. If you are arrogant, if you have a predetermined solution, which you just believe will attract good funding but won't necessarily solve a problem, you will never derive any level of satisfaction from your initiatives. But just to re-elaborate, if you are open, if you are humble, and you listen to your community, you can't go wrong. Because strangely enough, not many people care to listen to a community anymore. Everybody thinks that they have the answer and that their answer is the best. Yes. And so we are, to come back to an earlier point in your conversation, we are often solving not for the problem, but for the solution that we wish to impose. And I'm very proud to say that this has not been the strategic direction or the values-based concept of our leadership team, not in 1977 and certainly not now.
Maybe last question, August, is we speak about leadership. One of the things that I always keep top of mind is, as much as we wish to, leadership is pervasive. It grows beyond the boundaries of the organization. You're not just leading yourselves. You're leading a community, you're leading other partners, whether they're commercial partners, medical partners, nonprofit organizations that participate in making sure that this kind of service becomes available to communities, the value is delivered. So perhaps as a last question from my side, and with that form of leadership in mind, what is the message that you would like to share with, or the lessons that you've learned about leading a community, about leading others beyond your organization? Whether they started off with ignoring, being cynical, having had different prior experiences with the organization, how do you as a leader bring others that are not within your organization to participate in this?
Great question. So listening is truly underrated as a leadership quality, but it is, in my humble opinion, the most important tenet and the most important part of any conversation. You need to listen for 90% of the airtime, and you need to speak, if at all, for 10% of the time. If you are in a room with 50 people, as the leader, it is your responsibility to make sure that each one of those people has expressed themselves. And you need to be conscious of the nuances in the room. If you notice that somebody is not speaking, and they may be uncomfortable to speak in a public space, you need to engage with that person or that grouping as relevant in a meaningful way so that they are heard. Because everybody has an opinion, but not everybody is always comfortable to express that opinion. So whether it is an organization, whether it is a community, whether it is a society, the most dangerous thing is to assume that when people are silent, that they are satisfied. And in all of my leadership work and my experience in healthcare over these nearly 40 years, I have learned bitter lessons as a result of not listening and learning from those who are speaking. And it is a great personal challenge always for any leader to step away from hearing something that may not resonate or sit well with you. But that is where the greatest opportunity, in my opinion, lies. And through my experience, I've learned so much from listening to the primary customer, from listening to the person who's really receiving the value or not of your services. Because often we become arrogant and we assume that what we are delivering is still relevant, when in actual fact, people are just forced by way of circumstance to make use of your services, but they're not really making a meaningful difference.
Augusta, this has been a fantastic conversation. I really want to say thank you for joining us on this podcast. You gave us a glimpse into both the organization, to yourself, and the kind of challenges that you're dealing with. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon. Thank you for being part of this.
So it's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.